particular situation. I feel like I've totally learned something from and about old age, sickness, and death that no one can take away from me. At this point, I know what I know. I have lost my fear of death and of disability, which is my big fear about growing older. What is the definition of disability? The ADA defines disability in a very straightforward way as a physical or mental condition that limits one or more life activities for the afflicted person as compared to most people in the general population. The Oxford English Dictionary, which is my go-to source, defines sickness as the state of being ill. Now, ill is an adverb, and as an adverb, it's defined as badly, wrongly, or imperfectly. In other words, sickness and disability imply otherness and imperfection. There are several wonderful Zen koans that deal with the interaction of sickness, disability, and health. I'll start with case 94 in the Book of Serenity, entitled Dongshan Was Unwell. The case. When Dongshan was unwell, a monk said, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who doesn't get ill?" Dongshan said, "There is." The monk said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to look after him." And the monk said, "How is it when you look after him?" Dongshan said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." Think about that. The commentary, which is included in this koan, states, "The ancients, when about to die, frolicked in the realm of sickness, old age, and death. Among them, Dongshan is unusual, and everybody came to look in on him. One monk asked, 'You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?' Dongshan said, 'There is. Scratch that itch and the sickness fully remits.' The monk said, 'Does the one who is not ill look after you?' He carries out this order in reverse, wanting the people to know it isn't so. Dongshan then said, 'I have the opportunity to look after him.' If you figure it by conventional feelings, the one who isn't sick should be looking after the one who is sick, right?" Dongshan says, "On the other hand, I have the opportunity to watch over him. Is this the principle of inquiring after someone's health in a human sense?" The monk wanted to see all the way through. He asked further, "How is it when you watch over him?" Here it's necessary that you should always serve and honor at all times. Going to sleep late at night, getting up early to ask how they are. Only then is it known that you are someone who knows how to be grateful and obey filially. Dongshan said, "When I watch over him, I don't see that he has any illness." This is where everyday practice empowers you when you are dying. Dongshan also asked a monk, "When I leave this leaking husk," meaning my body, "where will you go to meet me?" The monk had no reply. Dongshan said in verse, "Though the students are many, not one is enlightened. The main mistake lies in pursuing the paths of others' tongues. If you want to name, to be able to forget physical form and obliterate tracks, work hard to diligently walk in the void." When he finished the verse, he shaved his head, sounded the bell, and sitting in the hall, he bade farewell to the assembly and appeared to die. They wailed in grief. He opened his eyes and had a meal prepared for the stupid assembly. He did die a week later. Dongshan is pointing to the appropriate relationship between our practice, sickness, and compassion. Linda Ruth, when she was talking about Seijo's losing her soul, in The Hidden Lamp by Florence Kaplow and Sue Moon pointed out that it takes a reunification of both parts, and actually the visible action on the part of the one who is sick, to integrate the sick and the well. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, it includes the essential ingredient of a conversation. Conversation means to interact or talk with someone in order to, and with the willingness to change. We talk to teachers, we talk to each other. Initially, Dongshan, who is sick, is taking care of the one who is well. How does that happen? How that can happen is when compassion is at work. This is where this compassion and sickness and disability get joined at the practice level. In Zazen, we allow whatever arises just to arise. We notice it and let it go. This letting go is not so easy, and it's one of the reasons we go on extended retreats. In a sesshin or even in a one-day sitting, probably you've gotten very little sleep, and we often become physically uncomfortable. Our defenses are less secure, our resistance more apparent to ourselves. And if we are lucky, we have an experience of staying with, in the present, whatever arises. 1 minute, we are the one who is not ill. The next minute, we are the one who is ill. We're not fighting with what arises and insisting on things being in a certain way. When we finally stop fighting, we discover the kind of freedom, like Dongshan, when he says, the old monk does not see that there is illness. Illness and health are unified and harmonized as the whole of our life, because in every moment, there is simultaneously one who is still or happy or skillful or connected and one who is active or unhappy, unskillful and lonely. Transcending these dualities does not mean living in a delusion. We live in this world of frightening COVID epidemic, which has only served to highlight racial and economic inequality and what the Republican Party is going to do next. And we live in this wondrous, miraculous world and in these beautiful, wonderful bodies. Both absolute and relative exist simultaneously. We are not living in delusion at this point. There's one last koan from the Blue Cliff Record that I appreciate for what it has to say about disability. It goes like this. I can't remember what case it, but I think it's case 87. Main case. Yun Man, teaching his community, said, medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? Su Chu's verse says, or responds, the whole earth is medicine. Why the ancients and moderns have been so mistaken? I didn't make the carriage behind closed doors. The road, though, is naturally quiet and empty. Wrong, wrong. Though there be high as the sky, your nostrils have still been pierced. What does it mean that the whole earth is medicine? In one of the very early sutras, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of great wisdom, was talking to Sudhana and said, bring me something that is not medicine. Sudhana was unable to do so. Then Manjushri asked, bring me something that is medicine. Sudhana picked a blade of grass. This is medicine. It can heal people. It can also kill. This right there is the contradiction. The whole world is medicine, and the whole world is also sick. So how does sickness and medicine inform each other? How do they interact with each other? I would suggest that they turn on each other like two pearls in sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Medicine and sickness are completely joined, and they cannot be separated. Pat O'Hara, who's a monastic in Bernie Glassman's lineage, gave a wonderful talk a few years ago that I read and found again for this talk. And it's also about medicine and sickness. The first three tenets and the first three tenets of Peace Order Fellowship. And in honor of Bernie Glassman, I just adore, I'd like to quote the last paragraph of it because it brought me back to what the relationship between medicine and sickness and great compassion ought to be. What she says at one point is, doing good for others is the third pure precept, which we call healing, making whole. And that's doing the appropriate thing, which flows naturally out of not knowing and bearing witness. The first and second precepts of the Peace Order Fellowship. When you are present to yourself and those around you, you do the right thing. You don't come in bustling with some right answer that you figured out beforehand. This is true on a personal as well as social level. Don't try to figure it out. Start with not knowing. Bear witness to yourself and those parts of yourself involved and allow the healing to occur. This, of course, requires great patience, great non-attachment to self. In other words, the basis of our practice. Zazen, the paramitas, liturgy, study, all with the mind of unearthing and accepting those parts of ourselves and healing those parts of ourselves so needing of healing. Most of us have, unlike Seijo, not one major split, but several splits or tangles, which we feel compelled to work with within the context of relationships and community. There is some kind of magic that happens in this interchange of conversation, and that magic is healing. And the healing is the interaction of sickness and medicine in the coexistence of disease and health. And it is possible. And it forms the basis of healing others, ourselves, and healing the world. So how is it that I'm practicing with this? More than 20% of Americans, nearly 57 million people, are disabled, including 8% of the children and 10% of non-elderly adults. More than two-thirds of Americans over 80 have a significant motor sensory cognitive disability. And while medical profession is devoted theoretically to caring for the ill, it doesn't do enough to meet the needs of the disabled. Among medical students in America graduating from medical school, only 0.5% described themselves as disabled in 2012. That percentage of self-declared disability among medical students has risen to 2.7% in 2018. Only 2% of practicing physicians have disabilities, and only 1% have a mobility disability like me. I finally realized that if I wasn't going to lobby for the changes that needed to be made, who was? Simple things like having the food service lower the counters in the cafeteria so that people in wheelchairs could have access to the food, or having the doors in the bathroom open outward so that if you were in your wheelchair, you didn't get trapped by the door opening. Not only that, but worse, I can't wait to find a physician who has a table that's adjustable so that a disabled person can get on it. Anyway, one would hope, in other words, that physicians would be the advocates for the disabled community as the profession that deals with disability, but it's not true. What is true is that if it's brought to people's attention, or if they have to be in a wheelchair for a day, most people really learn what the limitations are and become much more aware and compassionate as a result. How I practice medicine and Zen is very different from before the accident. I listen and I understand. Probably I'd been the most disabled person to have been Shuso within Zen Center. And everyone said afterward that it was very helpful to have me there. That's one of my identities. Of all my identities, I've least related to being a woman, or so I thought. The day that I began working on this topic, my mother would have turned 100. And for some reason, I was Googling myself, trying to find the title of something I'd written way back when. And I didn't come across myself, but I came across my grandmother and my great aunt, the two Graces after whom I'm named. Zen has led me, my partnership, to be very even keeled. It leads me to not identify with categories and ways of being, which in my experience has led to tangles. But conventional reality has really won the day on womanhood, at least for me. My name is Grace Meg Stammen. I was named after my maternal grandmother, Grace Meggs, and Grace Stammen, my paternal aunt. My grandmother was a physician and began Hull House in Chicago with Jane Addams. She also wrote the first document ever written on infant mortality in the world for the Children's Bureau in Washington in 1918, before women could vote. Mind you, before women could vote. And in it, she said, "It's unthinkable that in our country, 7,000 of the 15,000 women who died last year in childbirth did so from puerperal sepsis, which is like a big wound infection and totally preventable." And she said, "Colored people are twice as likely to die of puerperal sepsis as white people are." I'd never read this until I was working on this talk, but when I read Grace Meg's statement of more than 100 years ago, I thought, "You go, girl." Grace Meggs is also reported to have killed herself by jumping out of the hospital window where she was a patient after her fourth child died of sudden infant death syndrome. She probably had postpartum depression. I'll never know. I've never been able to substantiate any of this by getting access to her hospital record or police report. But nonetheless, she left three small, all children under the age of 4, and she stopped practicing medicine, which probably my mother thinks was the cause of her depression. And this is a big potential personal tangle. The other Grace I was named for, Grace Stammen, was the Mother Superior in the Sacred Heart Order and president of Manhattanville College in New York. She became one of the first Northern College presidents to integrate a Northern college in the Jim Crow era of 1943. In a widely publicized event that was followed soon after by other Northern colleges, she wrote, "This woman is not coming to college to make social contact. She's coming for an education that will equip her for the uplifting of her own racial group. She needs an education for leadership of her race. Manhattanville can provide an incubator in which to explore what will really help." My response, somewhat tempered by the racial complexity implied in that sentence above, was somewhat the same of, "You go, girl." Myriad things came forward to actualize this self. And looking back historically, I believe these Graces and their teachings have always been with me. I just realized this week, when I first decided to go to medical school, after asking myself in meditation, what was I meant to do with the rest of my life? I asked that often. The answer that came to me immediately was just going to medical school, spoken by Grace Meg, whom I'd never, ever met. I thought, you've got to be crazy. So I had this dialogue with the image of Grace Stammen. You've got to be crazy. I don't have a straight A average, et cetera. And I was a woman, and only 5% of the people in medical school at that time were women. In a dream, though, she said to me, I'll help you. And lo and behold, she must have. The only thing I had going was at that time was that I didn't mind the sight of blood. In any case, by the time I got into medical school, about 20% of my graduating class were women. I was the oldest woman in the state of California starting medical school in my year. I was 35 years old. Now I think the composition of the average medical school is more than 50% women. When I started, it was hardest on the young women. But by banding together, we made the situation tolerable, both for ourselves and for our patients, who were most likely women. I, after all, was a family practitioner, you know, cradle to grave. Women brought the kids to appointments, themselves to their OB appointments, and their parents to their own appointments. You know the drift. Not only was I a medical student and resident at a time when women were not widely represented within my profession, I had always also moved to Green Gulch Farm, a Zen community, where women were well represented in the community, but not in the lineage and Zen hierarchy. Without female Dharma heirs, there was little way for women to progress. Mind-to-mind transmission is what happens in Dharma transmission, and it's supposed to be the final ordination or barrier for becoming a true teacher. And in the early years, there were no transmitted women, and there was no way to have mind-to-mind transmission with a woman. So what really did I think? Most of the time, I just ignored it. I took on my not man, not woman identity, and I came out as a lesbian. I was very active in the women's movement, as had my grandparents been. They were part of the original suffragette movement. But at a personal level, I stood back from my womanhood. It's only been recently that I've begun to embrace and understand my female Zen lineage. I joined a Upaya online practice period, which celebrated women ancestors. And of course, I read The Hidden Lamp. Beyond that, and beyond chanting the lineage of women, which we did at Green Gulch Farm, I believe every minute, every other morning, I started reading some of the literature. And finally, I found a koan that absolutely spoke to what I felt comfortable with and how I would like to be able to practice for the rest of my days. Again, it touches on right relationship and true compassion. Both of these are key components, as you know, of the Bodhisattva path. When we chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, what we're really saying is I vow to live my life for the sake of others. This gave me a way to understand my predilection for community, because no one can do it alone. We all need community and teachers and a path. All of this has become my particular medicine, a community, a path, and people who will help me along that path. And I was lucky to have gotten to live at Green Gulch for about 27 years. I'd like to speak about Grindstone Lou. The koan about her is Case 60 from the Book of Serenity, or Case 24 in the Blue Cliff Record. She, to my mind, is the only female that has a koan named particularly after her in either collection. She's also in our lineage. I think she's number 27 when we chant. I'm going to the Book of Serenity version, Case 60, The Cow. Case. Iron Grinder Lou went to Guishan. Guishan said, Old cow, you've come. Then Iron Grinder said, "Tomorrow in Tian Shan, there's a big feast and gathering. Are you going, teacher?" Guishan lay down, sprawled out. The Iron Grinder left immediately. Wow. The backstory on Grindstone Lu is that she was born into a very poor family in 871. She left home when she was very young, wandered, stayed in convents a lot, and ended up in monasteries. She is described as very short and very clean. Nothing about her breast. Her full name was Liu Timo, and she was a student of Guishan, the other character in this koan. The meeting occurred during what's now called the Golden Age of Zen. At that time, Guishan had 54 transmitted disciples, of which she was number one. Think about that. It's like being the single parent, 54 children. It's harder. In any case, Iron Grinder had established her own monastery nearby Guishan's. The interaction takes place when Guishan was in his late 70s. He had built a monastery with his own hands, which at the time housed 1,500 monks. He was also part of a group of monks, cultivated fields, and raised cattle. When Buddhism first moved to China, they didn't work as long as there was a way to get support. In the north, during the early Tang Dynasty, they had been supported by the nobility. But as the monastery started to be located at very distant areas in the mountain ranges of China, apparently there were no villages to go back to beg. The winters were very severe. They needed to grow their own food. They couldn't rely on begging or donations from the literati. Maybe this was the reason Guishan called Liu Timo, "you old cow." In Chinese, the character for a male buffalo is different from that for a female buffalo. The character for a female buffalo means cow. By the time of this koan, which took place when Guishan was about 79, she had her own temple and was considered an equal to all the male teachers she met. In one encounter, Zen Master Zihu asks, "I have heard of Iron Grindstone Lu. They say you're not easy to contend with. Is that so?" And she replies, "Where did you hear that from?" And he continues, "It's conveyed from right to left." She replies, "Don't fall down, Master." The dialogue ends with Zihu driving her out of the room, beating her with a stick. There's a little hint of Liu's capacity to bend the relative world. Not easy to contend with and heard about from left to right with the absolute, as she tells Zihu not to fall down among these sorts of unhelpful comparisons and judgments. She was called the Iron Grinder because she was able to destroy monks in Dharma combat and grind them up. This was the modus operandi at monasteries at that time. In any case, Iron Grindstone Lu now succeeded Guishan, living on an adjoining peak, and came to visit him. A master said she was like stone struck spark, like lightning flash. Hesitate and you'll lose your body and your life. In the path of meditation, if you get to the most essential place, why are there so many things? This meeting of adepts is like seeing the horns on the other side of the wall and knowing immediately that there is an ox. This is a meeting of adepts. They function freely. They complete merging of student and teacher, teacher and student. Now it helps to know that Tian Shan, where the feast was to take place, was 600 miles from the mountain where they stood during this dialogue. In that era, There was no quick way to move 600 miles, let alone in one day. So what was going on here? There's no misunderstanding. They understand each other completely. She comes, he calls her cow. She asks him about going to a feast. He lies down and goes, albeit to sleep. And Grindstone mirrors him completely by leading. In true intimacy, there's no knowing, there's no saying, there's no eyes, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. These two are one reality and they function elegantly. Letting go and gathering in, it's a beautiful, beautiful dance. Samadhi reflects and is a fruition of fierce dharma combat. Their interaction is completely intimate and not hindered by words. Their intimacy in no, in which there is no knowing, no separation, comes out of wisdom. If, as I vow daily, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. I want to know what appropriate means are. The suggestion I just got was just be yourself and do that by forming relationships which are based on this coming and going in the true intimacy that Grindstone Lu and her teacher, Guishan, showed us. Thank you very much for giving me back my lineage. Grace Meg and Grace Damon would have loved Grindstone Lu, that short, clean woman who did whatever she felt compelled to do. And thank you also for giving me back my Zen lineage by making me look at what it is that I have to give and what it is that I have given as a result of my accident becoming disabled. Thank you.
Okay, if anyone has any questions, please raise your virtual hand. I'll start with one. There was, at the beginning, there was your story about Dongshan, and the punchline was something like, I take care of him. And I was when I heard that I thought, well, Grace, who do you take care of? But then you told us who you're taking care of. At least some of who you're taking care of. But maybe you would like to elaborate on who you're taking care of.
Sure. I will say that right now I'm working in COVID command in the city of San Francisco. So I take care of the clinicians who do contact tracing, case investigation. I take care of patients. I'm a clinician who acts as a consultant.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Can you say something about true intimacy?
That's a really great question. And what I feel like is that I saw or see really true intimacy between Grindstone Lu and Guishan. They are, you know, the case is just four lines, makes no sense. But there's a complete pas de deux in which they're dancing together. So intimately, they understand each other completely, and they do it without words. And I think that has a lot to do with true intimacy. I think we, or I anyway, get boxed in by words. And I think part of the beauty of Sangha is that we spend a big portion of our time not with words. we're communicating with each other, sitting next to each other. We're not necessarily talking. Did that answer?
Kenny, I saw your hand for a minute. You still have something?
My question was based on the movie that I saw a few years ago, and your daughter was going off to college at that point, and I just kind of wondered how it worked out for her, and because it's sort of like, oh, she wanted to go as far away as possible from home. Like, oh, off.
Now she's in Glendale. She's taking, and she texts me about every day. She's a tweet friends with whoever's the head of medicine at UCSF, and Monica Gandhi, who's head of the COVID crisis response in UCSF. Anyway, she's a Twitter friend of them. And so she will tell me before I even need to look at the paper, what is new in the universe. And, you know, she finally came out as being HIV infected. She's dealing with that. And she's doing great. But, you know, she's doing better than most grown-ups I know. But she does have a dog and two cats that are run crazy around the house. We have family Zooms every Friday night. My entire family, meaning my sibling, my three brothers and sisters, all of our kids, and any ex-lovers we have, you know, they all come. Our current partners, they all come. You know, aunts and uncles can come too. Sometimes we've had birthday parties. Sometimes we play games. Many times we just talk politics. And that helps. But I haven't seen her since last Christmas. That's when Fu and I both saw her. And she did give me permission today to fly down there because I've been vaccinated for, you know, about 3 weeks. And I'm so excited. Thank you.
Susan, I see your hand.
Thanks for the talk. You know, the intimate relationship, I was hearing an intimate relationship between you and the two women namesake, Graces.
Right.
Yeah. That was very, very touching and very inspiring.
I feel so lucky to have rediscovered that part.
I thought that was something too, like that, you know, you're talking a lot about lineage tonight, and also you brought up your own lineage that is so inspiring.
Well, yeah, I didn't think of it in terms of lineage, but yeah, exactly. And so we each, you know, I was thinking of my mother, who died many years ago. And as you were speaking of your Graces, and that's, you know, part of my lineage. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Well, I don't see any more hands.
Yes, I see a hand. Chris.
Now I see one. Chris.
I just had a question. The ideas of intimacy with the idea of non-duality, if you could talk to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what was so tricky about even looking at my own lineage. I don't want to look at any of those identities because that all of a sudden puts me in a world of duality, which I have felt is not the place to be. I don't think that's true anymore. I think we all have to claim both our conventional selves as well as our absolute selves. and we only get there by going through the conventional problems of reality. Is that an answer for you? Good.
Sarah?
Thank you so much for your talk and sharing your experiences, Grace. It was truly inspiring. And I have a question for you as a woman who's went into a male-dominated profession and who has practiced in Zen, which is a male-dominated religion. And you talked about how there were no women transmitted students as you were growing up. How do you think that has affected Zen in the United States, that lack of women teachers? That we have more now, obviously, but obviously you didn't have that.
And I think, Karen, you probably didn't when you were around. Yeah, there was no transmitted.
First,
Catherine Thanis transmitted by the when you were there. Okay. It's totally affected it. But, you know, I love Zen. I've been drawn to Zen. It's choiceless in my case. I mean, it makes no sense and it's choiceless. I don't feel like it's a choice I made. I feel like I got there and Zen grabbed me as much as I grabbed it. So, you know, it's something that's being changed in this generation. Lots of women transmitted now. There are lots of women teachers, and it's great. I have a male teacher. I finally said to him the other day, well, maybe I should have you and a woman as my teacher. What do you think about that? And he said, oh, it's fine. Do whatever you want. You know, but that's Reb. And he'll be my teacher for the rest of my life. Can't explain it. And, you know, just like being in a profession that's dominated by men, I mean, we have carved our way, and I'm only right now realizing how much a way I've carved, you know, what a different route I've taken. I mean, I took care of AIDS patients for years, and I still feel like I did it as a woman, and I feel like I did it, you know, majestically well as a woman. And I loved doing it. But, you know, we've got a complex history. Looking back all those years. I mean, think about Liu Timo. She left home when she was a little kid. She was described as clean. Nobody mentioned her breasts, thank God. Nobody mentioned that she'd had children or not. You know, she was clearly herself. She was clearly in charge of her own self throughout. I see a hand.
Grace, I just want to say thank you.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Karen.
Okay, sorry. I'm so impressed, and you must be so happy that you. I mean, you can. You're still doing the wonderful works in the world. I thank you so deeply for your great effort.
Thank you.
And your talk too, of course. I'll think of it as the talk of the three graces.
Thank you.
Peter.
Grace, I'm curious to know if you were consulted for the production of States of Grace, and specifically if you had any influence on the music that might be supplied for that feature.
Totally. But they were my friends who made the movie. So we Fu and I made the decision early on that we were not going to stand in the way of anything that they did as filmmakers. And we didn't. You know, I didn't even see the movie until it was cut and out. I saw the movie for the first time at Zenza, and I've got to say I was horrified. But anyway, you know, just because I am a very private person, we wouldn't know that watching that film. And I knew the woman, Laura Cartman, who did the music for States of Grace. That's really where they spent money, was on the music. And I loved her. I loved her. But, you know, that was all cut. We got to go to Lucas Studios to do that piece, to do the music part of, you know, blending it in. I don't know what you call that in filmmaking. But anyway, it's very fun. Going once, going twice.
Carolyn has her hand up.
Carolyn has her hand up.
I want to thank you so much tonight for your talk on several different planes. One is I've gotten diagnosed with multiple myeloma about 8 years ago, and it is really a blessing that I am still here. And the other part is you speaking as a woman and really addressing that and being very active in the women's movement back in the 1960s has been terrifying for me to watch how we've been moving backwards in that area.
I know.
And to hear you speak tonight and claim it, you know, claim it. And it's, you know, it's like hearing Helen Reddy sing "I'm a Woman Again" for the very first time. And for us to be doing that work again. And I'm happy to have you being a champion for that. So thank you so much for your work tonight, Grace, and modeling for me where I'm going. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Meg has her hand up now.
I just wanted to thank you, Grace. Struggle with my own disabilities and my own health issues, and with journeys close to death, and have always thought that I wouldn't give up what I learned because of those. And to hear you voice that today was very, very meaningful to me. And as I'm struggling with new things now, is to be able to remind myself that that's the case, that I will grow and change in light of. You know, I think our generation somehow, women have been carving spaces in our generation for a long time, and they haven't been easy places to carve, and yet to hear the impact that you have had, just thank you so much for your talk tonight. I thank you for the graces. I too, like Carolyn, thought of "I Am Woman" as you were talking. From a different time. Thank you so very, very much, Grace.
Thank you, Meg.
going, let's see, there was going once, there was going twice, and now we can go three times. Grace, would you like to
sure
take us out with the after lecture chant?
Yep.